we begin our proceedings, I just want to make a few very brief preliminary remarks. Firstly, I wanted to thank, on behalf of the panel and the court, Dean Jennifer Collins for all of her hospitality, and her staff has been great, and this has just been wonderful for our people to try to set up here. So we very much appreciate her efforts. And, of course, Professor David Taylor, who, if you don't know, he's a former clerk of mine, so we have a special relationship, and we thank him for all of his efforts as well. I'd also like to say that we do this at least once a year, and portions of our court, because we're a national court, travel to another location. And the best part of it is that most of our sittings are at law schools, which we really enjoy. I'd like to thank all of the parties, though, in the cases, because nobody ever complains, and for some of you, I realize it's a little heavier lifting than normal trip to Washington, so we very much appreciate your cooperation in all of this. First case is 182195, Sayers versus DVA. We've got split time here, so Mr. Scheer, you're first. Okay, we're going to run the clock individually, so you'll get your 6 minutes. Now, you represent
Dr. Sanders,
and you're...
I'm sorry. Yes, so my name is David Scheer. I'm with the Hoyer Law Group. We represent Dr. Jeff Sayers, the appellant. To my side, our counsel for AFGE, they will introduce themselves. They're part of the union. They've prepared an amicus brief, and they're prepared to argue also.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
And good afternoon, and may it please this court. Your Honors, in this case, the administrative judge misapplied Section 714D2A. That section requires the administrative judge to uphold the agency's decision if it is supported by substantial evidence. But that isn't what happened here. Here, there were two charges against the appellant. The first had several specifications, and the administrative judge did not uphold one of the specifications and then applied a razor-thin analysis, parsed out on the other specifications parts of the charges, and only upheld parts of those. As to charge B, the administrative judge quite skeptically only upheld what she called the gravamen of the charge. In sum, in this case, the administrative judge did not upheld both charges in their entirety and therefore did not uphold the decision. And thus, Section D2A is not satisfied
here. We've
had
these cases. I mean, forget this. I mean, that's a little confusing to me because
okay.
We've had a history of doing all these MSPB appeals.
Yes, sir.
So it seems to me the argument you're making has little connection to the high issue here, which is we're construing a new statute that applies only to them. Because your argument has been made for 20 years I've been on the court, and the answer is if the only upheld once, if there's enough for the deciding official to conclude that the penalty was justified on that one charge, that's fine. It happens quite a few times that you don't win on every specification in the charge, but you can still uphold the penalty on that basis. So that's not enough for you to prevail, I don't think.
Yes, so, Your Honor.
And the administrative judge did uphold both the specifications, just one of them on fewer than all of the charges.
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, the administrative judge did not uphold one of the specifications and partially upheld two of them, but did uphold the charge. That is correct.
Ultimately. Sorry, I mixed up the specification charge words.
Yes.
There were two charges, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And both of those were upheld.
I think incorrectly, Your Honor. That's actually...
Well, no. But again, you're starting off the wrong point. Our precedent says you don't have to uphold every single specification to find the charges supported. And if both charges are upheld, that supports the penalty. You have, I think, a different argument here because of the new statute.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we also do have, in addition to that argument, we have an argument about retroactivity, and I think that's kind of the main
focus. Well, that's their argument. Well, yes, your argument.
Yes.
Their argument is you waived the argument of retroactivity because you never raised it below. Is
yes.
there any dispute that it was not raised below?
We do not dispute that it was not specifically raised below.
Why not? Is there any reason why it wasn't?
To be honest with you, Your Honor, I was not the attorney below, so I don't know the answer to that question, except to say that we did raise several arguments of due process. We did raise several we did raise that we felt that the wrong statute was being applied.
Well, see, let me just say, we do a lot of different cases, and among those are PTAB cases, and we've really recently had tons of cases where they're challenging retroactivity. And the question is whether or not the board should have assessed the issue in the first instance. And we've typically said, really, not so much, because they don't have any authority to cure it, yada-da. But in this case, you could have, the AJ might have agreed with you. Indeed, several AJs at the MSPB have concluded, gone one way, and some others have gone the other way. So why wouldn't we hold you to a waiver where if you had raised this below, it might have changed the result and saved us a whole lot of time?
I think simply, Your Honor, we are here. This is an important issue. It needs to be heard. It's affecting thousands of employees. And I think it's an important issue to decide regardless of the fact that it wasn't raised below. And I agree, I think, I'm not sure you're saying this, but we believe that if you do apply that analysis to this case, there's simply no question that the decision has to be reversed.
Are there any factual issues that would have to be explored for us to decide the retroactivity issue?
No. I don't think there are any factual issues at all, and I think that's what makes this particular case somewhat unusual in the sense
that... What does reversal mean in this context? We vacate,
yes.
Assuming you were to prevail,
yes.
And we remand.
Yes.
How, you know... Can we remand just to the agency to make a decision? I mean, what's your view of the remand?
The remand.
Or the do-over? How far back do you have to go in the history of this action?
I think that the remand would be to the administrative judge ordering her to consider the case in light of the fact that she cannot consider any of the charges that occurred prior to the enactment of the statute, which in this case is all of them.
No. She can. You can. These charges might still exist. The argument is that there ought to be a different standard review, that there might be different time frames to consider.
Yes, Your Honor, of course.
But agencies are still allowed before this bring removal action.
Yes.
So the agency would not be precluded. My question is how far back you have to go. Do we send it back to the AJ for the AJ to then evaluate it under what your argument is the proper standard of preponderance and the pre-statutory changes?
Right. Yes, Your Honor, I think that the court should reverse entirely, remand it to the agency, and demand that the agency review the case in light of this decision, which we hope will be that this Section 714 cannot be used as a way to discipline or terminate the employee in this case because all of the conduct occurred before the statute was enacted. You're absolutely correct. There are many options that the VA has available.
That would still leave them free to... institute an action under Chapter 75 if they determine to maintain one under that.
Yes, and amongst other options. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think there's any basis for us to just order, since this, assuming we agree with you that we can reach it despite waiver and that it is an impermissible retroactive application, and those are just assumptions. I don't know that that's right or not.
Right.
Is there any way for us to tell the AJ to just convert this to a Chapter 75, or does the agency have to start at the outset?
I don't know how procedurally that would occur. I think the agency would have to initiate that.
Well, you still have the charges, you have the specification, you have the same evidence.
That's true.
Could we just order the board to apply the Chapter 75 standards to that instead of the Chapter 714 standards?
I am unaware of any rule that prohibits this court from doing that. So you could, but I think it would be more efficient to send it back to the agency, but you could do that.
Okay.
I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's hear from your friend here. Good morning. Good afternoon. I wanted to talk to you about the statute a bit, but before that, do you have any disagreement with your friend if we were to decide this case on retroactive application, what happens then on remand?
We did not brief the topic of retroactivity, and we were not we did not take any position on that issue.
Okay.
So I don't really have much to say on that.
All right. So tell us about the statute. Clearly, Provision B, 714D2B, couldn't be clearer, right? The board doesn't have the authority to mitigate.
Correct. And our position is not that the board can mitigate. You know, we are aware that the statute expressly precludes mitigation. However, we believe that mitigation and assessment are distinct. And as we've stated in our brief, we believe the decision that the board is reviewing when they're reviewing an action under 714 is a decision that includes both the penalty and the conduct underlying the charge or the factual predicates to the charge.
Well, sure, that's true. The action is the action. The action isn't just you stole some pens. The action is we're doing something to you. We wouldn't be here unless the agency had taken some action.
Correct.
So in the face of clear congressional, it's not congressional intent, it's the words, you can't mitigate, why isn't that enough to do what the agency did here?
Well, and again, it's not what the agency did. It's what the AJ can or cannot review. In this case, the AJ explicitly said that she was not able to assess whether the penalty was appropriate. And what we're arguing is that by determining whether or not substantial evidence supports the decision, the removal of the petitioner, the AJ must necessarily also assess whether the penalty that was imposed as part of that decision.
So then what meaning does B have? If you're saying that the agency does have...
Reasonable or authorized?
Reasonable. Or whether or not...
If you said assess and you said meant, well, AJ could say, this wasn't authorized, I might buy your assessment argument.
And to answer your question, Judge Prost, what would occur in a situation like this is which it would be a reversal. So you would reverse the charge. So, and I think this court, in a decision that was issued after this case was briefed, the Mogul decision, talked about a hypothetical where an employee stole a paper clip. And an employee with 20 years of service, outstanding, you know, everything else about the employee is outstanding, and they misused or stole a paper clip. Congress could not have intended for that employee to have no review of their removal. Under the VA's interpretation of the statute, the VA has unfettered discretion. And if Congress intended that, they could have used language that permitted that. And I think Section 714A1 is
so. What? How do you read the statute? So you're saying that the AJ does have the authority to mitigate and say, no, this paperclip abuse only justified a 15-day suspension and not a removal?
No, so the AJ does not have the ability to substitute the penalty that was imposed. Instead, the AJ could reverse. And I think the board—
In other words, Congress, we know why Congress was enacting this. They wanted to toughen the standards, make it easier to remove or to discipline Veterans Affairs employees, right? There's no dispute about that. You're suggesting that they did the reverse, which is now you're saying otherwise this person who stole paper clips under the old former statute would at least get a 5-day suspension or a 15-day suspension, and under this statute they go home free?
No, they don't go home free. And I think, again, the board's interpretation of the previous version of Section 713.
So just tell me, if they don't go home free, what happens to the paperclip guy under your reading of the statute? You said the AJ, we all agree the AJ can't change the penalty to a 15-day removal. So what should he do? What does he have to do?
He would reverse it and remand it back to the agency, essentially.
For what purpose?
For the purposes of imposing a penalty that is warranted.
Why would he remand it? I mean, this is a review. First of all, it's a different standard, so it is easier for the agency because all they have to do is prove substantial evidence for their decision, not for the charges, for the decision. And if they don't prove it by substantial evidence, generally in administrative cases, they've failed to meet their burden. So it's reversed. The decision lacks substantial evidence and can't be sustained. Why would you give the agency a do-over?
That's an issue that, it would be an issue for the board to examine on first instance. And I think it's telling the board promulgated regulations under 713 in which they had indicated that a similar statute where mitigation was not available for an AJ, the reversal would essentially be a remand because there's nothing precluding the agency from recharging the employee.
Sure, but that was under a different statute and different things and the like. And wasn't that a senior executive service position, which has all kinds of different rules applying to it anyway?
Correct. It was a different statute, and it applied to senior executive service employees, but the statutes read very similarly. And the board hasn't been able yet to interpret Section 714, and we believe, especially since the board hasn't been able to interpret it, that their interpretation of 713 is the closest thing we have to what could occur in a situation for, like the paperclip example.
But you're saying, let me just be clear, you're saying, so now you've adopted my hypothetical as well as Judge Hughes. So you're saying one of two things happens under this statute. If the AJ is not persuaded that the paperclip theft was sufficient to justify a removal, they can't do anything. So you told me they can remand it to the agency and tell the agency, do a do-over. So in effect, they can't mitigate, but they can in effect tell the agency has to mitigate. Under Judge Hughes' question, he was suggesting that you don't get a remand at all, which means the employee could be arguably much better off under this statutory provision than it could under the prior one, which seems, I mean, Congress makes mistakes, and maybe they made one here, but it doesn't seem to be consistent with what their intent was, right?
Well, and that's where we did want to highlight that we don't believe they will be better off under this statute because, again, as Judge Hughes highlighted, the substantial evidence burden is much lower, so it's going to be much harder for an employee to challenge the removal.
That's one piece of it, but you don't disagree that they will be better off if there's some concern over the penalty. Under the prior law, the agency could mitigate the penalty and say, at least we're going to suspend you for 15 days. And under this situation, even though, granted, the penalty is the standard, the burden is higher, they get nothing. It's all or nothing.
No, again, because under the other standard, the board would be mitigating the penalty, and the board would be making the decision of whether or not to reduce the penalty here.
So it's just a game.
It would
but
be pushed back to the AJ.
Under that prior mitigation standard, if the board found that even on one single minor sustained charge that any penalty was so disproportionate, they could order zero penalty, couldn't they?
In the prior standard,
in the
correct.
Prior
they
standard,
could, they
right?
Could order.
I mean, if the guy stole
entirely.
If there was a whole series of things that the guy stole a car, the guy stole a computer, the guy stole a typewriter, and for that he got or a paperclip. For that he got removed, and it turned out he didn't steal the car, he didn't steal the computer, he may have taken a paperclip. They can say charges not sustained at all, and we're not going to mitigate even on the paperclip to, you know, a day or something like that. There's nothing warranted here.
That's
so
correct.
That's part of their decision that the decision of the agency is not supported by, in the other case, a preponderance of evidence. That's just them showing that the action they took was not warranted. Isn't that what's going on here? Congress chose to use the word decision. They did not choose to use the word the factual evidence, the charges, or the like. And they know how to do that if they want to, because in our retirement benefits cases, the factual decisions of OPM cannot be reviewed by this court.
Correct. And that is our argument, that the decision that is being reviewed is a decision including the penalty. And here, again, the judge explicitly stated that she didn't have the ability to even look at whether or not the charge was appropriate appropriate.
I mean, isn't the mitigation standard that we're talking about, this is an old power that goes all the way back to the Civil Service Commission, and was always an independent power of the agency to mitigate. It's not wrapped up necessarily with just whether all or none of some of the charges are proven. It goes back to the fact that even if every single one of the charges were proven, the Civil Service Commission and then by, you know, succession, the MSPB could mitigate. It seems to me that the best way to read this is decide they don't want the board engaging in that mitigation authority anymore, but they're still subjecting the actual decision, which is not just the facts. It's the ultimate decision, as it says in the statute, to remove, demote, or suspend to full board review.
That's correct, and that is what we are.
How could it be full board review if all they get to do is review the facts underlying the charges?
That's correct, and I see my time is up.
You can finish answering, Judge.
That's correct, and that is what we are arguing, that the board must be able to necessarily review or assess the penalty when making that decision on whether or not the decision was supported by substantial evidence. And I think, Again, while Douglas does not apply here, the board's decision in Douglas demonstrated that historically the board and the Civil Service Commission always interpreted the term decision as including an assessment of the penalty. And what we believe should have happened here and should happen in the future is when an AJ is determining whether or not substantial evidence supports a decision imposed under Section 714, they still need to review whether or not the penalty was proper.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Brinton Lucas for the federal government. May it please the court. I'd like to start with the statutory mitigation issue. And
well, if you don't mind, just because we'll go in our order. We started with retroactivity. So why don't we start with retroactivity, if you don't mind?
Certainly, Your Honor.
So your view is they waived their right.
Yes.
Do you agree that, yes, assuming they did, we as a court of appeals has the authority to consider the retroactivity question, notwithstanding that it wasn't raised below?
I believe your court does have exceptions to allowing it to address issues not raised below, but there isn't any basis in the record below or that petitioner or his amicus have presented for why this court should address the retroactivity issue.
Here's one, so tell me why this doesn't ought not to at least carry the day or be substantial. The board hasn't had a quorum in a year or two. They may not have one in the foreseeable future. So you've got administrative judges deciding this, and there's a split in authority in the current cadre of administrative judges. Some are saying it was retroactive. Some were saying it wasn't. So we are looking at the possibility of people just going away and getting inconsistent results, or it just coming up to us again and again and again. So why isn't that at least compelling enough to say, yeah, we ought to think about taking a look and resolving this issue now?
I think the reason is because it would better come up under the ordinary procedures if an administrative judge, even without a quorum on the board, addressed the issue in the first instance by a party who had preserved it.
Why?
Because in that case, you would have a reasoned opinion by an administrative judge who tackled this issue, presented by a particular petitioner.
But it's a pure legal issue, right? You agree it's a pure legal issue. There are no facts that need to be explored by the administrative judges. There's nothing else that needs to be here. We can decide this. And decided as a legal issue whether it applies to retroactively to conduct before the act was passed or not, right?
It is a legal issue, Your Honor, but this court has considered legal issues to be forfeited, and we believe that here. But setting waiver aside, I'm happy to turn to the merits of the retroactivity issue, and I think it's important to split this up into two parts. So the first part, petitioner complains about that the mitigation bar was applied retroactivity. It seems he has essentially abandoned that in his reply brief. He doesn't address that issue at all. And it's telling because the mitigation bar is a quintessential jurisdictional rule that should not be treated as having any retroactive effect.
Yeah, but we all know the differences. And the stark differences, the differences begin with the timetable from from the notice of proposal and so forth. That's a difference. He had shorter time in his case because the statute was retroactively applied, right?
Certainly, Your Honor, but I believe...
And he did have the different burden, and the burden didn't just come up... The burden shift isn't just with respect to the AJ, right? Didn't the deciding official also apply a substantial evidence burden under the new statutory provision? I don't recall.
A few points on that, Your Honor. Yes, the VA director did apply a substantial evidence burden, but that's not in the statute. So to speak, the only thing the statute addresses is substantial evidence on appellate review. And we think for the purposes of administrative appellate review, changes in the procedures and the standards of appellate review are classic procedural issues. So let me just give you an analogy.
But the problem here is it's not just a change in a burden of proof. If you take your whole reading of the statute altogether and your view prevails on how the statute operates, you are giving them far less rights onto what they get review on. Your view is they only get review on the factual evidence supporting the charges, not the ultimate decision itself. And isn't that quintessentially a substantive change in the authority of the board and their due process rights?
No, Your Honor. We believe that this is a change in jurisdiction as to who gets to review the particular instance. And all it is saying is that the administrative judge cannot mitigate the penalty.
That doesn't make any sense under Loudermill. The whole point of Loudermill is you get initial pre-termination rights that are speedy and quick if you get a full post-termination review by an independent adjudicator. And what your reading of this statute does is take away a full independent review by an independent adjudicator and gives them a much more limited look into what the employee did. I don't see how that's not even that's even remotely procedural.
Your Honor, I think it's important to separate out two issues, the retroactivity versus the due process. With respect to due process, I'm unaware of any.
But your arguments work against each other. If you prevail on your merits of the reading of the statute, then what they're getting at the end of the day at the MSPB is a much lessened form of review and much lessened due process rights than they got before. Isn't that true? If before they got a full review of the charges, the evidence supporting them, the reasonableness of the penalty, and whether it's negotiated, your view now is all the board gets to do is look at the charges and say, yeah, up or down, they're supported or not. They don't get a review of reasonableness. They don't get a mitigate. Isn't that a drastically substantive difference in the scope of independent post-decision review?
I don't think it's any different from perhaps the example that was given in Landgraf itself, where the Supreme Court discussed the statutory issue of a jury trial right being given. That's obviously going to make a significant difference in a lot of cases if you elect to have a jury trial right rather than a bench trial. It may affect a particular claimant quite dramatically in making it less.
But that just affects the adjudicator. It doesn't affect the scope of the review.
With respect to the scope of the review, Your Honor, I would just analogize this. It's outside of this context, but in the Fourth Amendment context. So when the Supreme Court said that it was clear that it was decisions about reasonable suspicion and probable cause were reversed, reviewed for de novo review rather than clear error, they told the courts of appeals to apply that new standard to cases on review. That's a significant shift in how things are reviewed on appeal, and it will affect the rights of the particular litigant.
But it didn't change the content of what reasonableness is, did it?
No, and neither does. Changed.
Yes, it does. It means they only get the facts underlying the penalty, not the whole ball of wax reviewed.
Your Honor, if I can extend my analogy a little bit further, what they're saying is that it's the same shift as from clear error to de novo. Under clear error review, you're not going to be able to take certain factual findings into account unless they're clearly erroneous. Whereas under de novo,
you don't get to challenge them. Here, they don't get to challenge it at all. It's out. Doesn't matter what burden of proof, what standard of review, they don't get a challenge under your view, the reasonableness of the penalty.
Your Honor, and again, I would submit that with respect to jurisdictional changes as to what court or what administrative agency gets to hear, that would not be inherently retroactive. That would be the sort of classic jurisdictional change the Supreme Court discussed in Landgraf. But turning.
Why don't we just move to the merits? I mean, I don't understand your retroactivity argument at all, but. Because it certainly seems to me that it's a substantive change. Why is your reading of the statute right when the statute says the administrative judge shall uphold the decision of the secretary to do certain actions if supported by substantial evidence? It doesn't say uphold it if the facts are supported by substantial evidence. And there's a difference between facts and the decision, isn't there?
Your Honor, I think the key phrase in that statute is if supported by substantial evidence. And we know that substantial evidence is primarily a factual
review. No. Wait a minute. Let's look at the statute. The statute says if the decision is supported by substantial evidence. And the decision in the same sentence in the earlier part is characterized as the decision to remove, demote, or suspend an employee. I don't see how that's limiting. The word decision is limiting. It says exactly what Judge Hughes just said. The decision includes the penalty.
Certainly, Your Honor. So let me try and clarify this if I can. The decision, when you're reviewing it for substantial evidence, is you would look at to see whether substantial evidence supports the underlying conduct that the secretary chose.
Well, you're entirely rewriting the statute with those words. I mean, isn't this directing the administrative judge to look whether substantial evidence supports the ultimate decision to remove, suspend, or the like? That's what the statute says.
No, Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that is. And I would just point you to Douglas.
Can you look at the statute? That's what it says. Shall uphold the decision to remove, demote, or suspend if supported by substantial evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. And the way that this would work is if the decision is supported by substantial
what
evidence.
What decision? The decision to demote or the decision to suspend? That is a portion of the decision. That's the decision. It's the decision encompasses the penalty.
Yes, Your Honor, but just so I can make this clear, the substantial evidence part of it goes to the underlying charges. Because
how do we know that?
Because substantial evidence is a primarily a factual determination. And you look at...
Sure, it's primarily a factual determination, but the facts can include application of certain factors, for example, right, by a deciding officer. Isn't that a fact?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And let me just point you to Douglas, where it discusses this
right.
particular issue. So it says, substantial evidence you review for the factual determinations underlying the charge. Then Douglas, in a separate section, goes on and say, you apply reasonableness review, and that is an entirely substantive, different review. But substantial evidence alone is you are just looking at the underlying facts to make sure that the Secretary's decision is factually supported. And that carves out a role for the board to engage in review.
Can I just ask you, this is really just a neutral question. Mm-hmm. Under your reading of the government's reading of the statute, what is our authority? Do we get to still on appeal, even though the board or the AJ do not have the authority to mitigate? And in your view, they're really just passing on whether the facts support taking charges. What do we get to do? Don't we get to, under arbitrary and capricious, also review the level of the penalty applied to the conduct?
Your Honor, I don't think that's been the case, at least with respect to Chapter 43 cases, and that is what we understand.
You know what? The Chapter 43 cases don't get you very far, because Chapter 43 was a special procedure designed to give employees plenty of due process before the termination decision. They were given an opportunity to improve. They had to be given clear guidelines and a time to see if they could meet it. And the decision at the end of the day is if they don't meet them, that they can't do their job. There's no mitigation of, well, you can't do your job, so we're only going to send you out for 40 days. If you can't do your job, you're out. So I don't understand why those Chapter 43 cases are all that analogous when what we're talking about here is misconduct and how proportional a agency decision is to punish misconduct.
Certainly, Your Honor. So let me explain if I can. The Chapter 43 cases and the discussion in Lisiecki of the performance improvement period and all of that, none of that had anything to do with Lisiecki's holding that, and upon discovering an implicit mitigation bar, that the board was not allowed to review for reasonableness or apply any of the Douglas factors. Those were entirely separate. They were discussed. And they were not part of the holding. And with respect to the procedures, I think it's very clear that Lisiecki made quite clear distinction between due process procedures, notice and opportunity to respond and the like, and the fact of the performance improvement period, which was simply another measure. There's nothing in that in Lisiecki that would say this changes our holding depending on whether there's a performance improvement plan. In fact, Lisiecki discussed those cases.
But in Chapter 43 cases, you have to have a performance improvement plan. It's part of the statutes and the regulations supporting it. It's not optional.
Certainly, Your Honor, but we don't think that has anything to do with the mitigation authority. And to our knowledge, neither petitioner nor his amicus have provided an explanation for how
you have mitigation of an agency decision where the agency removes somebody because they're incompetent. The board agrees that they're incompetent, but yet they'd mitigate it. That doesn't make any sense. It's just a matter of logic that there's no mitigation in performance cases. The same is just not true of misconduct cases where you are punishing people, and the severity of the punishment depends upon the severity of the action. Can you think of an instance where an agency gives somebody a 180-day performance improvement period with clear, specific guidelines and quantitative factors and the like? At the end of it, this person fails every single one of them, and the agency says, you're out. The board says, yeah, they failed every single one of them. The person is unable to do their job, and they would mitigate?
Your Honor,
how could you mitigate somebody that can't do their job back into their job?
Well, I hate to do your job, but isn't one of the answers possibly that you would demote them rather than remove them?
Well, sure, that applies too, but that's the agency's choice to determine. Sorry, I don't mean to answer your question. You're a little unlucky because I did this for 20 years.
And I did it too.
Yes.
And I'm sitting here thinking, in the Army, they just make him a cook.
But even the demotion is not really mitigation. It's the agency's obligation, if they have procedures in place, is it not, to put somebody into a position they can perform. It's not really mitigation. It's putting them, if they were promoted beyond their means or the like, back into a position that they can actually accomplish.
Your Honor,
the board can't do that.
With respect to the mitigation under Chapter 43 cases, The fact that Douglas held this, and yes, to the extent there are different procedures in Chapter 43, that wasn't at all a part or key aspect of the holding of the Chapter 43 seminal precedent of Lisiecki.
And I mean, we can all read Lisiecki. I don't think you're going to convince me, at least, on differing what that case means. So can you get sure. back to...
Can I get back to statutory questions that we had before? I think we covered this with your friend, but I don't recall covering it with you, which is, under your reading of the statute, let's say what is the AJ supposed to do if they say, this is crazy, they fired this guy for stealing a paper clip, but I don't have authority to mitigate? Does the AJ, we know the AJ can't mitigate. In your reading of the statute, does the AJ still get to look at the penalty and send it back to the agency and say, you need to take another look at this, or is it over?
I see I'm out of time.
No, please continue.
No, Your Honor. The AJ would look at that, and if the charges were not supported by substantial evidence, then he could not mitigate or mitigate through remand. And I do think...
No. I don't think that's the question. The question is, the AJ determines that the ultimate decision is not supported by substantial evidence because the penalty is so disproportional to the underlying misconduct that it can't be sustained. If that's the decision of the AJ, what does the AJ do? It finds the decision unsustained and the person that action's overturned, or it sends it back to the agency for a do-over?
Or is it forced to affirm simply because, yes, he did prove that he once took a paper clip, and you can't bother yourself with whether he should have been fired for that?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be the answer. And I would just like to underscore.
And can I get your answer if you take that option off the table of the prior two options, what the government prefers?
Could you please, with all respect,
either
just give
the
me the two
option? Not sustained, and so it's not sustained. The employee has to be put back to work, which is what happens when an action's not sustained, or the AJ sends it back to the agency to consider what further course it would take.
The latter, Your Honor.
Where's the statutory support in the statute or basic principles of administrative law for that?
I think since this is a fallback, and I think this just sort of underscores why this isn't allowed under the statute, that presented with a case where substantial evidence supports the underlying charges, the board can't mitigate or can't do the same thing through the back door by simply sending it back or
substantial evidence, again, live with the hypothetical. It's not substantial evidence doesn't support the underlying charges. That's the way you want to read the statute and the words you want to put in it. Substantial evidence doesn't support the decision to remove.
Right, and if substantial evidence doesn't support the decision, it's because the facts underlying the charges aren't supported. Because
I know you want to confine this to facts, but certainly there's Supreme Court precedent and the like that when it's talking about an agency decision, it has to be the decision itself. And if it is so grossly misproportionate to the underlying charges, then that agency decision can't be sustained. Isn't that the whole basis for the Douglas factors and the like, is that these are APA cases and that on appeal to us, we're going to do an APA-like review, and therefore any agency decision is going to be subject to arbitrary and capricious review by us as well?
And Your Honor, I would just like to underscore, with respect to the Douglas factors, one of the Douglas factors and one of the key aspects of the analysis is the efficiency of the service standard. And there's no efficiency of the service standard here, just like in the Chapter 43 context.
But it still has to be supported by substantial evidence. And it doesn't just say the facts. Let's just assume I disagree with you. You can stop wasting your time arguing that that actually means facts. So the AJ gets to review the whole thing for whether it's supported by substantial evidence, including whether the penalty is disproportionate. What happens then?
On that premise, then, if he concludes that it's not supported by substantial evidence, he can't uphold it, and then presumably would send it back, as in any other sort of context.
Is that what happens in regular APA cases when an action's not sustained? I thought it's just not sustained. If the reviewing court finds some procedural deficiency or something that was unexplained, then they can send it back. But if it's just the decision's not supported, then doesn't it just get reversed?
That's the general matter, but sometimes in cases there is remand without vacature, and in that context...
I suppose your hook could be here that really implicitly what's happening is the AJ is finding that the decision to remove wasn't explained enough, so they need to, or the proportion of the penalties, and they need to go back and think about it and give a better explanation of why a certain action should be taken, and implicit in is that is they can reconsider.
Certainly, Your Honor. Under the theory that substantial evidence review includes some sort of reasonableness component, then I think we would analogize this to arbitrary. So
we've been talking about this. Let's assume we even agree with you that this only allows AJs to review the underlying charges. And so the AJ, like in this case, said, you know, I didn't sustain some of these. I sustained some of these. I'm going to sustain the penalty because I don't think I have any room. We review this under a typical APA standard, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you don't read the statute as reading out our arbitrary and capricious review.
Your Honor, it would be strange for this court to be able to review something that the underlying judge or the, excuse me, administrative
judge.
Wouldn't it
also be really strange to read out APA review, which is specifically somewhere in Title 77, I believe, and they didn't change Title 77 for these cases?
Your Honor, we're not asking you to rule out APA review. We're just asking that sort of the ordinary procedures be followed. And I think in the Chapter 43 context, there's no mitigation either by the administrative judge or by this court and with respect to a penalty. So we think the same would apply here.
Isn't the core of your argument that the intent of the national legislature was to drastically reduce the rights of existing rights of VA leadership so that they could be removed as quickly as possible, and that barring the Constitution, the legislature could do as it pleased?
I think without framing it as drastically reducing rights, but changing the procedures so that the VA could quickly remove employees who were engaged in misconduct within the bounds of the Constitution, then yes, I think that is the underlying focus of the VA Accountability Act.
Isn't there a constitutional process
exactly.
problem here?
You took my follow-up.
Sorry. Go ahead and ask it.
But go ahead. Isn't there a constitutional problem?
Not at all, Your Honor. Look, petitioner here received ample procedural due process before his termination.
Talking about pre-termination. We're talking about post-termination. Isn't that kind of the gist of all of this is you get much less fulsome procedures pre-termination if you get fulsome post-termination procedures. And clearly here, this statute tightens up time frames to the extent it allows the agency to sustain it under a lower burden, lots of those kind of things. I think you probably have pretty good arguments on all that stuff, as long as it gets a fulsome review post-termination. But your view is it doesn't get that full view post-termination either. Isn't that a violation of due process?
No, Your Honor, a few points. First, petitioner has not pointed to any authority, and we're unaware of any, where it violates the procedural due process provision to have limits on post-termination review. And secondly, it's not completely—
They have a property right in their employment.
No one is disputing that, Your Honor, but the question is whether—
And you're saying that their property right in continued employment can be taken away without anybody reviewing the reasonableness and the proportionality of the penalty compared to the actual misconduct. Any independent adjudicator. And I think if you look at those employment cases, they all emphasize that post-decision review is usually done by an independent adjudicator. Your view of the statute takes away the right to have an independent adjudicator review proportionality.
Your Honor, that is true, and all that is the same is true with respect to Chapter 43 actions. So if that violates the Constitution, then Chapter 43 actions presumably would violate the Constitution.
Let's assume I just don't agree that your Chapter 43 analogy works, because there's a difference between performance, which is an up or down answer, and misconduct, which can be punished by a range of penalties.
Again, Your Honor, I understand that point, but I don't think it goes to any sort of procedural due process analysis. And at the end of the day, petitioners have yet to articulate an explanation for why Chapter 40.
Okay, let me ask you another hypothetical. Congress decides this is not working well enough, and they say, you know what, the agency gets to decide this, no review whatsoever after the fact. Not even limited review, no review whatsoever. In your view, isn't that just another taking away more procedures, but they still have procedural due process before the termination decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you think that Congress can take away tenured federal employees' properties rights and make it apply retroactively to people that already have existing property rights?
Again, Your Honor.
Do you have a case for that? Because I'm pretty sure that it's inconsistent with a half a dozen Supreme Court cases.
Again, Your Honor, just to be clear, and as you pointed out, we have a good case on the pre-termination process, and I am unaware of any of the post-termination cases that would say that this sort of scheme would be unconstitutional.
Employees have to have post-termination rights. I mean, that's in Loudermill, I think.
Your Honor, in Loudermill, it discusses the balance between pre-termination and post-termination.
Yes, but implicitly, the reason you get to have expedited and less than fulsome procedures pre-termination is the assumption that you get fulsome post-termination procedures. And you just told me that Congress can take away a employee with due process property rights in their job any kind of post-termination proceeding. That seems to be a sweeping, extraordinary statement.
A few points, Your Honor. First, if the pre-termination procedures were sufficient, then there would not be a need for any sort of post-termination review. But secondly, in this case,
You're not arguing that they meet the post-termination standards of being performed by an independent adjudicator with the right to present evidence and all of that kind of stuff. That clearly doesn't happen at the VA.
Your Honor, at the VA, petitioner did have a significant chance. He was given an extension of time to respond with a lengthy reply and over 300 pages of exhibits. He was
given. Didn't get an independent adjudicated decision, though, did he?
It was adjudicated by the VA, who carefully reviewed it. And to the extent, I'm unaware of a holding that says that any time an administrative agency adjudicates something that's not an independent decision. I think that would be a remarkable sea change in the law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be very brief. First of all, I'm quite certain that Congress cannot strip all federal employees from having any judicial review of decisions made against them. If Congress wanted to do that, it could have made...
Well, is it enough that we get to review under arbitrary and capricious the APA standard? Is that enough?
I'm not arguing that point. We're talking about appellate review, yes. I'm simply saying that if Congress decided to leave it at once the agency makes the decision, it's over. That can't be constitutional.
Well, nothing we're talking about in this statute
right. Speaks
to our authority.
Yes, and I'm just the only other point I wanted to make, Your Honor, is that I was thinking about what is the best in this case if the court is planning to reverse a remand. I believe that the court should reverse and send it back to the agency. That would have the effect of reinstating the employee. But, of course, the agency has a number of mechanisms available to it to recharge the employee if it so choose to do so.
I mean, if we find that it was applied impermissibly retroactively, they could always charge it under Chapter 75.
Yeah, exactly, Your Honor. That's right. Unless there are questions, that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Both sides, and the case is submitted.